Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
The Slaughter Podcast will be discussing topics that some listeners may find disturbing.
If you're still listening, did it, bong.
Hi guys, welcome to the latest episode of Slaughter.
Welcome to the Passive Aggressive Podcast.
Yeah, this week we're going to be mainly talking about that bitch. She knows who she is.
That sounds like some sort of podcast related aggro, but
It's just life aggro. Other life aggros, we're slaves to technology and the only way to free ourselves is to send bombs in the mail.
What the fuck is this episode?
I've been watching Manhunt Unabomber and I feel like I identify with Ted Kaczynski way too much.
Like, it's people listening going, these girls have joined a fucking cult.
I think, like, honestly, put a soundtrack to something, like a bit of cinematic camera, and I'm sold. Like, I am riding the Kaczynski truth train.
This is why you should only watch nice things.
This is why no one should teach me how to make bombs.
For reals.
No, not really, but honestly, it's on Netflix, and if you watch it, like, they're not trying to make Ted Kaczynski seem like a nice person. He killed only like 3 people, so
what?
I find my perception slightly skewed because I was like, only 3? But he did maim a lot of people.
Oh, well.
Yeah, but they do a really good job of portraying his character.
Stop idolizing.
I'm not idolizing
technically
him.
A serial killer. 3 people.
He was fucked up. Like, the government did experiments on him when he was 16 years old. He just wanted someone to love. He just needed love. I could have loved him.
What kind of experiments?
Like, mind control. It was part of MK Ultra, I think. So, like, when he was at university, he had a guy who's his therapist, and then they would, like, practice torture techniques to see if they could break him.
Fuck.
Yeah, watch it. It was really good. And obviously it's all based on a true story. And then you can start researching Ted Kaczynski and then, like, Google image what he looks like now. And then try and see if there's a porno called the Unabomber. There isn't. I was disappointed. It's like a week's worth of work.
Bit homophobic.
It doesn't have to be a gay porno. They can stick a dick up a woman's ass. Equality! Anyway. Watch Manhunt Unabomber on Netflix is the story of this tale. Don't send bombs to people in the post. I'm not condoning sending bombs to people in the post or putting dicks in anyone. Unless they ask for it. And that means, like, verbal consent, not, like, just with
their
eyes.
Just stop. Right. So let's go on to a safer subject. Have you got a murder to talk about?
I have got a murder to talk about. So I've had a bit of a shitty week. So to cheer myself up, I thought I'm going to do a murder from one of my favourite books, Killer Doctors.
I thought you were going to say one of my favourite killers.
No, not a favourite killer, but Killer Doctors, The Ultimate Betrayal of Trust by Kenneth Gibson.
Classic.
Love that guy. He's not of the PC generation. And for that, I love him.
You don't give a shit.
Yeah. But so this is... a story about a guy called Dr. William Palmer. I've never heard of him before.
Palmer oil or Palmer ham?
P-A-L-M-E-R.
Okay.
So he was around in the 1840s. So a historic case. Quite high numbers of suspected murder victims. And there is actually a lovely period drama starring Alfie Allen. What's the main Allen called?
Allen. I don't
know. Lily Allen's dad. What's he called?
Oh, Roger Allen.
Nope.
Robert Allen. To start with
Dave Allen.
David Allenborough.
Lily Allen's dad is in it.
I touched a signed picture of David Attenborough this week. It's the highlight of my week, genuinely.
How did you get your hands on it?
David Attenborough's touched this. I got one of my students to write to him and ask for it.
Nice. So there's a lovely period drama about it. I couldn't believe I hadn't heard of this story, but it's a good one. And so he was mainly, as a doctor, obviously your main method of murder is quite obvious. You're going to be medicating people to death, which he did. And it's said that the phrase, "watch your poison," sort of originated from this case.
Oh.
Because...
So it's got to be in a drink then.
So he was born on the 21st of October in 1824 in Rugeley in Staffordshire. It's an area that they basically have a Brummie accent, but no one really talks about it. And so his father wasn't really an educated man, but he'd risen from being a sawyer to a man of wealth and status, having made his fortune as a timber dealer. Though it's thought that he was sourcing much of his timber illegally, sort of just going onto other people's land and chopping down their trees and selling it on. William Palmer's father did die when he was 12, but because he'd amassed such a fortune, it meant that William was able to continue at grammar school until he left at the age of 17, which was quite good going in the 1800s.
Oh no, grammar school was free, wasn't it? But
yeah, it was free, but it meant that he didn't have to go to work and support his family or anything. Yeah. So he became an apprentice at a chemist's, Evans and Evans, but his love of money meant that he was soon sacked because he'd been stealing the payment that came in the post.
I always find it weird when there's two people, clearly like married or brothers, who set up a business and they're like, let's call it Evans, but there's two of us, we'll call it Evans and Evans. Evans will do. Right. Yeah, it covers both of you.
I never thought
it's
of
a blanket
that.
Term. Marks and Marks. It's just, there's no need. Marks and Spencer. All right, you both want a shout out in there. But when your name's the same.
That's just blown my mind. I didn't even think of that.
There you go.
So it was only really the fact that his mum agreed to pay back all the money that he'd stolen that stopped him from going to prison over that. So his mum seemed to make excuses for his behaviour all the time. She was satisfied that he'd only stolen money, not because he was greedy or because he was vindictive, but because he did it for romantic reasons. He was in love with his girlfriend. She was older than him, called Miss Jane Widnall. And he basically just wanted to spoil her. So he can't be blamed for stealing other people's money. So it probably was the only thing keeping Jane interested in Palmer, because she dumped him as soon as she found out that he wouldn't inherit any of his father's money until he turned 21 in 3 years' time. Like, that's not long to wait.
Yeah, 3 years.
Nope, not hanging around till then. She'll lose her bloom.
Now, I see things on Facebook and it says this was 4 years ago.
And I'm still wearing that outfit now.
Yeah, I'm still digesting that now.
Sorry. But his mum was like convinced that he should be cut out for medicine. Obviously that's a nice status position and she wanted to raise them up, so she then got him an apprenticeship for a Dr. Tilecoat, though this was also quite short-lived. He was unreliable as an apprentice, as most apprentices are. He had a bad reputation locally for just putting it about quite a bit.
What, into ladies?
Into ladies.
Into vaginas?
Yeah, he was putting it in them, out of them, shaking it all around them.
Just in the vicinity.
Just wafting.
This is how I say hello.
I'm just going to wave my dick around, and if it goes inside, it's your own fault.
Pheromones.
So he even burned his bridges in the village, really. He rekindled the romance with Jane Widnall, and they eloped together. But he did this using money that he'd stolen from Dr. Tilecoat. He once again escaped persecution because Mother Dearest said, you must come home and I'm going to repay all the money. So she's pretty much enabling his bad behaviour at this point. And this time she went ahead and secured him a place as a walking pupil at Stafford Infirmary, which I want to know, like, how does he, she's obviously not giving any references for him because he's stolen from the last two people he worked for.
Yeah.
So either his mum is faking references or she's really good at blowjobs. Who would take on that kid?
No one.
At a hospital where people's lives are at stake. You're like, he's unreliable, but go on. So he enrolled in 1844 when he was age 20. And even at this stage, he was showing an interest in poisons particularly, though he wasn't allowed to take any home for personal use. So around here, the timeline for William Palmer gets a bit muddled up. There was things reported in a newspaper at the time and later. And so basically there's two versions of the next section of his life. So one says, mainly in the newspapers, that at 1946, one point here, he met a friend called George Abley and they went for a drink at the Lamb and Flag Inn and they were drinking brandy together that night. And then Palmer, instead he was going to go, he basically did what I do to you and said, oh, I'll just go and get you a half, and then came back with like 3 pints. Oh,
that is a dangerous concoction. My most drunk nights have been where I've said, oh, I won't have another drink, and you've come back with a double.
She knows what she's doing. She'll just say, I'm not going to buy another one. I want to be sober. I'm like, too late. I've bought them all.
Too fucking late.
So that's basically what Palmer did. Brought back more than they'd asked for. And then after they downed them all, Abley left the inn because he was saying he stumbled off to go be sick. And then...
yeah, that's usually how my nights ended up as well.
And he was found later on dead in a stable.
Oh, fuck.
So following this, Palmer was sort of viewed with suspicion in the village. No one could really prove anything, but he then left to continue his studies at Bartholomew's in London, which makes sense that there was this bad sort of situation, so then he moved to London. The other version of the story is that he, for unknown reasons, was studying in London, graduated as a doctor, then came back to Rugeley. And this is probably because there was a later date on the death certificate than was reported in the newspapers. So it's confusing. In this version of the story, he challenged George Abley to a drinking competition. And it was sort of said that he was trying to force him to get wasted. But then again, he was left. Everyone went to search for him and he was found dead out in the cold. So George Abley had been a plumber. He was 27 years of age, which to me, I would have thought, you know, young, sturdy, but I guess plumbing in the 1840s was basically like wading in sewage. Mm. Not really the sanitation we have today.
Did they say what he died of then? Was it the cold, lying in the cold?
Well, this is the thing. So he was described as being a pale, sickly sort of guy. And the inquest concluded that it was natural causes.
But he's going to die soon anyway. He looks...
yeah, there's like, it's quite reasonable to expect. He doesn't look well. He's not particularly strong constitution. He's been drinking heavily on an empty stomach. He's passed out in the cold. So it just sort of happened, is what they went for.
I would have been fucked then because I've always been pale. And do you know when I used to go and fake it at the school reception and be like, oh, I don't think I'm well. I'd always go, you do look pale. You do look sickly.
I need to see actual vomit. Just my face. Going home.
Yeah.
But however, the foreman of the inquest jury, he believed that Palmer had an ulterior motive, in that he'd taken a fancy to George Abley's wife when he treated her as an outpatient at the hospital. And obviously this couldn't be entered into formal evidence, so it was sort of just his say-so and like rumours on the jury, so it couldn't be taken into consideration. But he said that she refused his advances.
Were his advances just following him down the corridor, just waving his penis around?
Who knows? But she said she was loyal to George, she wasn't interested, and then suspected that that's probably why George had... that's probably why Palmer had tried to get George out of the picture.
Like, maybe if her husband was dead, she'd like me.
Maybe if she has no other options.
Yeah.
So it's also said that while studying for this doctor's qualification...
yeah.
Like, I just like, who? Is that what it's called?
The doctor's qualification.
While he was studying to be a doctor, William Palmer found the time to father at least 14 illegitimate children.
Whoa.
Though he put his medical knowledge to good use by working
as a... I wonder what you're going to say. He put his medical knowledge into a lot of ladies.
Well, he worked as an abortionist on the side.
Oh, fuck.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, what, of his own children?
Yeah. It's basic supply and demand, isn't it? Like, I'll make the babies.
I'll make the supply.
I'll get paid to sort them out after. It's a self-sustaining industry. I don't know why you're looking so shocked.
I think if a guy... I'd want mates rates at least.
If you got me pregnant and you're an abortionist, I'd want it for free.
Yeah.
But 1846, he had qualified and he had moved back to Rugeley, where he then opened his own medical practice. Now, he did quite well at the beginning. So Palmer was able to hire a man named Ben Thurley to sort of lighten his load. But he did that so significantly that Palmer was then able to pretty much spend the majority of his time gambling at the racetrack. So he wasn't really content with placing small bets. Palmer eventually had a stable of 15 racehorses, and he'd rinsed his entire inheritance from his father when he was 21, and he'd run up so many debts that eventually he was banned from running his horses or selling them. I mean, that's bad. They wouldn't even accept his money for anything, because they knew he was a bit of a dodgy dealer. So October 1847, Palmer married a lady named Anne Thornton. So she was a ward in Chancery. So basically the court had appointed her a guardian after her father had died. And they would give her an income of £250 a year that when she married would go to her husband. But her unfortunate circumstances came about. Her father had been an officer in the Indian Army and he'd actually killed himself. And weirdly, he had, I think it was 4 brothers, and 3 of them also killed themselves.
I think that does happen sometimes, though, that you can have a family where there is a lot of suicide.
Well, Kenneth has opinions on this.
Oh.
He's not alone in these opinions. These are also shared by the period drama that I watched. But Kenneth lays the blame with Anne's mother.
Oh, God, how fucking scary was she?
Well, how?
They all jumped out the window.
So here's a quote from Kenneth. Quote, "No doubt the colonel's death was at least partly to escape Anne's mother. Mary, a foul-mouthed alcoholic brawler who'd been his former housekeeper and mistress and never stopped cursing him for refusing to marry her." Like,
sounds like most mothers, to be honest.
He'd been in a position of power. He'd got her pregnant. And then just because she said, "Will you marry me and make me respectable?" It's like, "Well, the only thing to do is kill myself." It's not her fault.
Yeah.
She can curse him as much as she likes. It's not the sole reason. But I think the consensus is pretty much that he killed himself. Rather than marry the woman you have a child with, you're going to die. Like, how bad could she have actually been?
Yeah.
Kill her.
Fuck no.
Like, if someone's got to... Anyway.
When you said how bad would she have had to have been, I immediately pictured, what's her name, off The Weakest Link?
Anne Robinson.
Yeah. It's just like...
If Anne Robinson was begging you to marry her, you'd be like, this is it, I'm going to end it all.
From 0 to 10, I think my 10 is Anne Robinson. That's
did
concerning.
Not know that about you.
I didn't know that about me.
So Palmer had first met Anne when he worked with Dr. Tylecoat, and they would visit the school where Anne was. They were only like a couple of years older than apart, so it wasn't like pedo levels, but they had stayed in contact over the years. So they were married. Anne was clearly in love from her letters, and she was incredibly grateful that a sort of middle upper class doctor was interested in this, obviously a bastard at the time. So she gave birth to 5 of Palmer's children, though tragically 4 of them died of very sudden convulsions.
I mean, it's tricky to know if that's suspect at those times. I mean, it's a bit suspect they died of the same thing, but kids were sort of dropping like flies.
Yeah, infant mortality wasn't great in Victorian times. It was probably slightly better in like the wealthier, just because it was cleaner.
Yeah.
But like you say, it's an easy out.
Yeah.
Because babies did just die.
They'd lose a lot of children, and then they'd name future children after the children that had died as well. That wasn't seen as bad taste.
You're like, I'm going to get a Mary no matter what.
Yeah.
But there were rumours of foul play in the deaths of the children. There was a cleaning lady who worked for the Palmers, and she was convinced that William Palmer was giving the babies poison when she wasn't present, as they'd all died when he was like, oh, leave them with me, I'll look after them. Mm. And that's when they would have the convulsions.
Yeah.
She apparently ran into a pub convinced that he'd dipped his finger in poison and then put his finger in honey so that the babies would suck it. But she had no evidence of it. She hadn't seen it. So nothing was done. Anne's alcoholic mother, Mary, she lived near them in Stafford, and she lived quite simply. She wasn't really looking after herself, and she just lived on her own, let her house go. It was basically like hoarders. She had more cats than she did flannels. So it's thought that Palmer was convinced that the mother Mary had inherited Anne's father, the colonel. He thought that she'd inherited his 9 properties following his suicide. And he felt that she's not really doing anything with them. She's wasting away in this one little house. We should have a share of this. So 6th of January 1849, Mary was invited to come and stay with the Palmers so they could look after her a bit more. But once she arrived there, she very quickly became seriously ill and died about sort of 10 to 12 days later. So an elderly colleague of Palmer, Dr. Bamford, he was like in his late 70s, early 80s. He was partially blind, but he was Palmer's go-to guy for death certificates. So yeah. He was called over and he named the cause of death as being due to apoplexy, which... no doubt, that's what many mothers die of. My mum would threaten to die of apoplexy on a regular basis, just for drama's sake.
Can you bring it on yourself? What is apoplexy?
It's like a hysteria, isn't it? Like,
yeah. Upset lady.
There's more to it than that, but...
she died of her period.
I thought I was going to die of my period this week.
She died of womitis.
Or at least kill another person.
I think you nearly did.
So it was soon discovered that Mary had not inherited any of the colonel's houses. So Palmer was not particularly pleased.
So he killed her for nothing.
Or so we think. So then there followed a series of unfortunately sudden and suspicious deaths around Palmer. Though he was never formally investigated for any of them. 1850, there was Leonard Bladen. He was a bookmaker and he was owed quite a bit of money by Palmer. So they'd been to Chester races together, and then Leonard had come to stay at Palmer's house, where, of course, he became suddenly quite ill. Bladen's wife then heard about this and rushed to Rugeley, and she was there in time to see her husband delirious and die this quite painful death. She then noticed that his record book, where he kept obviously details of who owed him money and things like that, was missing. And he'd already written home saying, oh, I did quite well at the races, I'm going to bring home £1,000 or so. But he only had £15 on him. She couldn't find it. So she then went to Palmer and said, didn't you owe him quite a bit of money? Can I have it back? Mm. And Palmer said, I already paid it him and he spent it while we were at the races. So managed to wangle his way out of that
convenient.
One.
Convenient.
1852, a man named Joseph Bentley died 3 days after a drinking competition with Palmer. The doctor had gone to Mrs. Bentley, who was obviously clearly distraught, and had given her some pills to calm her down. So whether it was like out of hysteria or just the fact that she was suspicious, she threw the pills out of the window into the garden. So
and the whole garden died.
Well, the next day, several chickens were found dead in the garden.
I mean, couldn't that just be legitimate if a chicken has a pill?
If a chicken has a paracetamol, does it die?
It explodes.
No.
Yeah. No, I don't know. Depends what pill. Gets rid of its headache. You can give a dog paracetamol.
Like legally?
Yeah.
How do you know a dog's got a headache?
I know, that's a problem. Leg ache. It's like the legs hanging off. Give it a paracetamol. It's fine.
So 1854 now. So Mrs. Ann Palmer, very like her mother, was also taken by a sudden bout of apoplexy. So she began vomiting straight after breakfast, which had been served by Palmer, and which this was on the 19th of September, 1854, but she died a week later. She was also 27 years old. So Palmer's life insurance policy that he'd taken out just earlier that year was able to pay out a tidy sum of £13,000.
Whoa.
So this amount was enough to tide him over and keep the wolves from the door because of his mounting debts, but it wasn't enough to keep him going with the lifestyle that he had. So he began in earnest to try and find an insurance company that would insure the life of his brother, Walter Palmer. So Walter wasn't in great shape. He was an alcoholic as well, and he'd also gambled and squandered his inheritance from his father. So he was like, fine, you can take an insurance policy out on me for £400. Like, he didn't really care. Of course, William never paid him that money. But he managed to keep Walter sober long enough and took him to a doctor friend of his who said, yes, this is a fit and healthy man, so that he could actually get the insurance policy he wanted. And that was on the 5th of April that year. So by the August, Walter was back on the drink and died following a particularly heavy binging session. So not only did William Palmer immediately begin trying to claim on the insurance policy, he also went to Walter's wife, Agnes, informed her that her husband had died, and then said, by the way, he did owe me £300. Could you pay it back now?
Fuck.
Agnes was like, can you piss off, please? So she refused to pay.
I literally just found out about my husband. Have you heard of that scam that people used to do that would, if someone died, then they would go around. This might have been on a TV show and people shit, but they'd go around and because you didn't have the internet or magazine shops, they'd be people who sell pornography, and they'd go around to the widow and say, we're sorry that your husband died, but he also owed us £300 for pornography. And because it was so shameful, the widows would often pay it because it was embarrassing, just to get rid of these guys, and they'd make some tidy money.
Sounds legitimate.
Sounds a shitty thing to do.
That is very mean,
but very clever.
The insurance policy didn't pay out either, though, for Walter, mainly because William Palmer was getting so arsy about it. They were like, bit too grabby. Yeah.
Yeah.
So Palmer tried again to insure the life of someone, and this time he tried to take out a policy on his friend George Bates. But insurance companies were now incredibly suspicious, and they hired two detectives to look into Palmer's claims. So he got wise to this, and Palmer just ditched this plan and tried something different. His debts were now mounting even more. He was also being blackmailed by a former mistress that he'd performed an abortion on, promised to marry, and then didn't. So she was threatening to release 34 letters that he'd sent her. So he was in serious, desperate times at this point.
What was in those letters?
Just details about the abortion, about their affair, right. Things like that. So 13th of November, 1855, Palmer went to the races with a friend, John Cook, to watch Cook's horse run. It was called Polestar.
Polestar.
Not a stripper. I think reference to the North Star.
Right.
And the horse raced and it won. So it earned Cook the sum of £3,000, which is around, it's a couple of hundred thousand in today's money. The following day, Palmer and Cook were drinking brandy together. And Cook suddenly got up and said, something's been put in my drink. My throat is burning.
Sure.
And obviously Palmer was like, sit down, it's fine. But after a bit more time, he began to feel really, really ill. So the next day, Palmer convinced Cook to come back to Rugeley with him so that he could look after him. But Cook refused to go and stay at his house. He said, I'll stay at an inn. So he stayed at the Talbot Arms, which was opposite where Palmer lived.
Where Palmer happened to work in the kitchen.
Well, Palmer was treating him with pills. And every time he would take a dose of medication, Cook's condition worsened for the next few days. And Cook himself started to blame the illness on the prescriptions from Palmer.
Yeah.
So he had to then become a bit more sneaky. He went to a woman in town and asked her, can you make me a broth for my friend who's ill? He took the broth home, poured it into a different container and took it back to the woman and said, can you take this broth to the inn and say it's from a man called Jeremiah Smith, a solicitor. That's a real guy. So Cook would have been like, oh, okay, it's from him.
Oh, yeah, but why is he sending you a broth? That's pretty weird.
Exactly. And it's obviously
it's my homemade broth that I couldn't bring myself, so I got a stranger to bring it. That's very odd.
Yeah. He obviously was like, he won't eat it if it's from me because I'm trying to kill him. So Cook had a spoonful, thinking it's Jeremiah's broth, and was sick immediately after Jeremiah's broth. Isn't that like what Michael Jackson called his spunk? Like Jeremiah's broth.
I'm just going to have a little bit of Jeremiah's broth right now.
So Cook was sick immediately after taking it, and a maid just quite innocently had a spoonful herself when she saw it was going to spare, and she was sick straight after eating.
Oh, I love it. She's like, oh, free food.
Palmer then went to London for a few days. He went to collect the Polestar winnings on Cook's behalf. While he was away, he also met with a chemist on his return to procure some more strychnine, which is a type of poison. At the time, not really quite well known, that hadn't been involved in any murder cases at this point. So workers at the inn noticed how dramatically Cook's health improved with Palmer gone. He felt instantly better and seemed to be improving. Cook's own doctor, a Dr. Jones, he was sent for to sort of avoid Palmer looking after him, but Jones then spoke to Palmer, who also called in his elderly colleague Bamford for his dodgy death certificates. And together, the three men agreed on a prescription that they felt happy with. Bamford prepared it and Palmer collected it. So it took hours and hours to persuade John Cook to actually take the medication. And once he had, his body went into convulsion. So much so that his head touched his feet, like he jerking backwards that much. Now, this is a typical sign of poisoning with strychnine. And within a couple of hours, John Cook was finally dead.
So Bamford's been a shit as well there then.
Oh yeah, I think he's more inept than involved
but if
in
went
it.
To
he's a bit of like a stooge for him. He went to prepare it, but I think he prepared it thinking being totally trusting.
But
and
he was
Palmer
blind, wasn't
went
he?
And collected it and then was able to tamper. He was just sort of ailing sight, not proper blind.
Not proper blind. Not real blind.
John Cook's stepfather, when he heard about this, was very suspicious of the sudden death. He demanded that an autopsy was carried out on the body, mainly after realizing that Palmer's made all the funeral arrangements before any of us even got here.
Before he even died.
Palmer is a beneficiary in my stepson's will. And John's record book of his bookmaking accounts is missing.
And the banner saying, yes, he's dead, I'm rich. Alice didn't help.
So this autopsy seems absolutely insane. It was supervised by the same doctor who had signed off Walter Palmer, the alcoholic, as being fit and healthy. So he was mates with William. So the guy who was in on the insurance scam was in charge. It was carried out by one of his apprentices who'd never done an autopsy before and was so nervous that he'd had enough brandies to basically knock him out. And William Palmer was present at the autopsy, sort of helping out. So he was able to sort of sabotage it. He was apparently jostling the surgeons as they worked so that they were dropping the samples. He was able to pick, they were obviously going into the stomach to look at the contents so they could test it for toxicology stuff. But when they got the stomach out, he was knocking them, they dropped some, he picked it up and was able to leave the room with it before anyone could stop him, and then came back in with it. So he was tampering left, right, and center. Luckily, the results were so sort of inconclusive that they wanted a second opinion, and another post-mortem was ordered and carried out. This time they took samples from the stomach, and these showed the presence of antimony, a favourite of the teacup poisoner.
Yeah, Graham Young.
Yes. And the original toxicologist who'd done the first test, he still claimed it was strychnine poisoning as the cause of death. And he wrote a letter with all of his reports to the Rugeley authorities outlining what he'd found. Amazingly, Palmer had a friend who worked in the post office who was able to intercept the letter and steal it before it arrived. The postmaster was Samuel Cheshire, and he was later sentenced to 2 years in prison for his perversion of justice in this case. Eventually, they had an inquest into the death. And following that and the discovery of a forged check from Palmer, he was arrested for the murder of John Cook on the 15th of December, 1856. He did try going on hunger strike while he was in jail, but he relented as soon as they threatened him with force feeding, which at the minute in class we're doing about the suffragettes. I'm like, bitch, you can't even stand what they did. I haven't told the kids about force feeding yet. I'm a bit nervous.
Yeah. Well, in case they try it.
A little bit.
Eat this donut.
Shove the cheese down your throat. So as part of their investigation, the body of his wife, Anne, and his brother, Walter, were both exhumed. So Anne had been dead for about 15 months. She was still in quite good condition. And the samples from her stomach, they found lethal doses of antimony. Walter, possibly due to his shitty lifestyle, the fact that he basically fermented his insides, he'd only been dead for 4 months, but he was absolutely rotten. So when they opened up the casket,
that's why you shouldn't drink, kids.
Yeah, apparently the gases that were released made everyone immediately vomit. They'd done it in the Talbot Arms Inn, the same inn across from Palmer's house. I don't know why.
Slap it on the table.
Yeah, pretty much. And then they said that business really suffered because they could not get the smells out for like years afterwards. They could just smell his rotten flesh.
It's almost like seeing into the future, isn't it? Like a reason not to buy a drink. It's like classical conditioning, isn't it? Like this is what you're going to end up smelling like.
Smell this pub. That's your insides. Yeah. So on him, there was no evidence of poison found, basically because he was rotten as shit. But they said that this probably shows that it's cyanide poisoning, which leaves no trace. So while awaiting murder trial, Palmer had to go to court on a separate issue where a moneylender was claiming payment on William Palmer's debts, but he was claiming it from his mother, Sarah Palmer, who was the guarantor on the checks. Now, Sarah had never signed these checks, so she said, it's not me. And when William Palmer took the stand, he claimed that his deceased wife, Anne, had been the one who'd forged his mother's signature. And so the case was dropped. Which is incredibly disrespectful. You've murdered your wife and then you've blamed her for your forgeries. Yeah. Just like the final kick.
There's no way I could fucking forge my mum's signature. It's so tricky.
Will's signature, I'm not even joking, fuck it, I'm gonna say it on the podcast because he deserves to be have his identity stolen. It's a straight line. Like it's a W for Will and then a horizontal line. And he was like, yeah, but I can do it the same every time. It's not the same every time. It's terrible. He's got no money, but fuck it. If anyone wants 20 quid, W, straight line. He won't learn until something's done. So the trial began on the 14th of May, 1856. It was an incredibly grand affair, a huge spectacle, and many members of the aristocracy had come to see it. Partly because the news made such a big deal out of it because he was quite a well-to-do, upper-class doctor, not just some ragtag. And also the trial had been moved from Rugeley down to London. So obviously it was a bit more of a society event. So this was, like I said before, this was the first ever trial where strychnine was said to be the poison of choice as the murder. And there were huge arguments. A lot of the evidence and the defense and the prosecution was about what the actual symptoms were of strychnine poisoning in a human, because it just hadn't been observed enough. So basically they knew it was violent convulsions, but they were arguing over what caused it. And eventually they decided that the only other thing that could have caused the same sort of convulsions as seen in John Cook would have been if he had tetanus. But if he had tetanus, they were saying then there must have been some sort of wound where he'd caught it that would still be present at the time of the convulsions, which there wasn't. So it was also confirmed that Palmer had bought the strychnine. He just said he bought it because he wanted to poison a dog.
That's all right then.
Yeah, whose dog?
They'll lock him up for that.
So it still seemed quite unlikely that he was going to be found guilty. There wasn't really any hard evidence. He was a doctor, so of course he's administering drugs. There wasn't enough toxicology results to say. It was a lot of circumstantial evidence that he was there, then they got worse. And he'd bought poison, they think it's this poison. But there was so much circumstantial evidence that it was hard not to think. Also, at this time, it was still precedent where the defence didn't give any closing arguments. So they thought, fuck, we can't even sum up what we believe. Despite all this, though, the jury took less than 2 hours to find the guilty verdict. William Palmer was sentenced to be hanged on the 14th of June, 1856. So while away to be hanged, he'd hinted that he'd murdered other people. He'd said, well, I didn't use cyanide to kill them, but he never said that he actually had. It's thought that he had been responsible for at least the deaths of 14 people. 30,000 people came to the execution in Rugeley.
Whoa.
And at the time, the town only had a population of 4,500. So it was
a lot of out of town.
Flooded it. Yeah.
That's all those Londoners.
He was a bit of a joker. When his last words, he went up to the gallows, looked up at the rope, and said to the executioner, "Are you sure it's safe?"
That is quite good.
Yeah. Apparently, he just like in the crowd, led balloon,
lolling along.
He was the last prisoner in the UK to be buried without a coffin.
Oh, really?
Yeah, they literally just shoved them naked into a sack and buried them. But he was the last one it happened to.
Although a lot of them, didn't they just stick them under a slab? I'm sure.
Yeah.
He
did get a death mask made. Oh, and really? At the time that Kenneth was writing, it was held in Staffordshire County Museum.
Oh.
So if you're in Staffordshire, hit me up with the info of whether it's still there. I'm not Googling it. And that's that story.
I liked it. So, it's my go. And I have decided to do Mark Hobson. He's got a very similar name to a friend of ours when we were younger, and we used to knock on his door and bug him all the time. Why don't we just...
You'd be like, can we come in? Can we come in?
It was before mobile phones, wasn't it? So we couldn't just text and say... Because he lived around the corner from me, and we'd just literally turn up and say, hi.
We would force him to hang out with us for long periods of time.
Although he did fancy me for a while, so I think it was proximity more than anything. So I'm doing Mark Hobson, who is... I did look, and no one's done him on a podcast, but it's quite a good one. So I am a pioneer delving into him headfirst for the first time. A lot of the information I got, because there wasn't a lot online, there were just some really short articles, so I got from the YouTube documentary Married to a Spree Killer, which very much went from the point of view of the wife and children.
Is it one where they do reconstructions?
No. Thankfully. But
unlike Frenemies on Netflix, which is another shitty show that I watched the other day.
Frenemies.
It was a bath show. So not like worth the actual TV.
Yeah, like the quality is way lower. Like that, what was that film I watched, that drag queen film?
Cherry Pop.
Nope.
Hate it.
It's awful. And then the bloopers are just them stopping because a train's coming past. So Mark Hobson was born in 1969. In Wakefield, in Yorkshire.
That's the worst. Please don't.
And that's my
Yorkshire.
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 Yorkshire. What's the time?
Oh, God.
Throwback!
It's callback,
isn't it? It's callback. Throwback's like the 90s. like throwback to the 90s. Throwback to my childhood. So he can be described as a spree killer, and because all of his crimes just came at once. So in 2004, he was working as a bin man in Selby, which there's nothing wrong with, in North Yorkshire.
The fact that you had, when there's nothing wrong with, suggests that you do think there's something wrong with it. We told you there would be passive aggression in this episode, yeah. And there it was. Lucy hates Yorkshire bin men.
They're going to come at me.
Yeah, they're going to tip rubbish all over your house.
There's nothing. It's one of those jobs that the kids at school are like, you know, I don't want to be a bin man when I grow up.
You only have to work mornings. Who's laughing now?
And actually, it's pretty good pay if you drive the van. Just saying.
You get to jump up. It's high up.
Yep.
You get to look in everyone's windows.
You don't even have to touch the bins if you're in the van. But also,
you get to piss off drivers on the way to work by being really slow and being like, lol.
And also the kids who are like, oh God, I don't want to work in McDonald's. I think, you can't do fucking math. There's no way McDonald's are hiring you.
You're not clean enough to work in McDonald's. No. Have you smelt a teenager?
So, it's an interesting one because he totally changed just one day. So he married his childhood sweetheart. They'd met aged 12 or 13 and they'd broken up. They were on again, off again, as you do a lot when you're a teenage. And she'd married someone else and had children, but that kind of fell apart. So she met up with Mark.
Do you think they met again on Facebook? I'm sure that's ruined so many marriages.
I think they just still lived in the same area. So they ran into each other. And the fire was reignited and they totally clicked. And he totally invested in the children, which are called Emma and Bobby. And I always find the name Bobby really funny because I remember me and my brother when we were little, we used to think Bob was the funniest word. Like, you've just bobbed yourself. Stop bobbing yourself. The documentary I watched, and I watched it on two different, because it froze up on my phone, so I played it, and it was a different version of the same thing. And the whole family had really weirdly deep voices. And I thought maybe...
Were you just watching the video slower?
Well, I thought that, but I don't think I was, because there was one that was 2 hours, and I thought, oh, well, it's obviously a documentary slowed down to double. Then I watched the one-hour version, and they sounded the same. I think he must have had a Barry White voice and just passed it on to everyone. Maybe everyone in Yorkshire talks like this. Proper deep, like, in Yorkshire.
Loose.
So his wife, Kay, had a third child with him. And he was a very attentive, very loving father. So his daughter was called Alice. She described having quite a happy childhood in her younger years. And then he told Kay that he wanted to adopt her other two children. So he wanted to be with them full time. And so he married Kay so that he could adopt the children.
Lovely.
Respectable, lovely. And then...
You don't have to get married, but lovely.
Well, you did then.
Oh yeah, for sure.
To adopt. It all sort of changed one day. It was New Year's Day and he just... they went out for a drink on New Year's Eve, Kay and Hobson, and he just said to her, I don't really want to be with you and the kids anymore. Stayed at someone else's house and she was... absolutely mortified. I mean, they had a lovely Christmas together. He'd seemed really happy.
You've just adopted the kids.
Yeah.
So what do you do? Like, is he saying, like, if you've adopted them, then there's yours. So even if you split with the mum, is he still going to see the kids that he's adopted? Or is he like, actually, they're not as appealing?
Gone off him. I don't like that name. No, I think, I mean, he stayed in the area, but it was just so sudden. I was thinking, did he have a blow to the head that sort of changed his personality? Was there a brain tumor or something? Because it does seem really weirdly different. But then I was talking to Luke about it, and he said that he knew someone in the same situation who had just literally all of a sudden just decided, this isn't for me, and that's it. But it was a total shock to the whole family.
I would be on board with that he just had a complete change of heart. But the fact that you mentioned he's a spree killer, when, as soon as you said that, I thought, was it a blow to the head?
Because he'd done nothing up until this point. And then within 2 years, his life dramatically changed until he was doing horrific crimes. So I feel like it was something. I feel like there was an illness
found out about and didn't want to tell anyone.
Brain damage, some sort of brain decay. I don't know. I feel like it was something. So he stayed somewhere else, then he left the family literally the next day. He packed a bag, so he went round, said, yeah, I still want to leave you, and left. But he continued living in Selby. So, I mean, after that, they did sort of try and get back together, but he'd started drinking. And he just, she said that he just wasn't the same, and he started being really aggressive with the children, shouting at the children. The relationship just wasn't there anymore. And he, and she, in the end, she said to him, can you please go? Because he was different, and she wasn't happy anymore. So 2002 is when Hobson commits his first crime, and he got really angry at his friend, who he'd been friends with for years, in the middle of the street, in the middle of the day. I mean, that's not to say he wasn't drunk already, but he stabbed him 5 times in the middle of the day in the street, and he punctured his lung.
So he had some stabbing equipment.
Yeah, he'd obviously got something, a knife, pen knife. People used to carry pen, oh no, this is 2000. 90s was pen knife era. And it was such a small community, word got around really quickly. So Kay found out pretty quick because someone said, oh, do you know what your husband's just done?
And he wouldn't believe it, would you?
She didn't at first.
Oh, he's left me and now he's stabbing people.
Yeah. And all he got was, because he'd never had any previous convictions, 100 hours community service for that. That's nothing.
Stab me once, community service. Stab me twice.
5 times. Fool you.
Look, I'm not the Proverbs person. I like that. Like, you can get away with one stabbing. Like, everyone understands the need to stab at least one person.
No.
Like, in your, like, you've got a stabbing allowance. You use it wisely.
Everyone's got a quota of one stabby.
They have to have really pissed you off.
One stabby day.
So if you think that person deserves the stabbing, fine. But you're not going to be able to stab the next person that pisses you off.
No, and get away with it.
I think about it more carefully. It would make me maybe not stab the people that were annoying me because I think, well, you could annoy me more.
So, following this, he met Claire Sanderson through some friends. Very pretty, brunette. And they started dating and they got on pretty well. But when they were both drinking, and she had a bit of a drinking problem as well, so that was pretty regularly, they'd get very volatile, they'd get very argumentative. They both moved in together and they lived above a pub, which didn't really help because the temptations there, isn't it? I remember when I was at university, there were some people that were also at the university, and my friend always wanted to go to this one pub because she fancied a guy who lived above it, and he was there all the time. And he worked there, but even when he wasn't working there, he was just constantly in the pub. So, they actually got barred from the pub, though, because she's...
That they lived above.
That they lived above.
Never come downstairs.
And that's good money. I mean, that's...
You must climb out of the window and go about your business.
Because she smacked him with a pool cue and bit him on the head.
That's your one pool cue smacking for this year. You don't get any more.
So...
You can do 2 pool cues in your lifetime.
So Hobson... would still see his family, but when he went around, he'd cause lots of problems. So he'd argue with his children quite a lot. They were getting a bit older now, particularly the ones that he'd adopted rather than his...
Well, you would, wouldn't you? You'd be like, you adopted me and you left me. Like, that is a lot of...
Mm.
Like, that's a lot to for a teenager who would argue with the with their, you know,
well, I think
biological dad who stayed with them and loved them and was fine. Me and my dad could argue over absolutely nothing. And he didn't really do anything that wrong.
Well, I think he was seeking out the arguments more than them as well. And he would just take a dislike to who they were dating, even though really he had no claim on what relationship they were having anyway. So he would sort of punch walls, he'd smash windows, and he'd threaten to harm his own children. His daughter talked about an incident where he'd started choking the older adopted daughter. So they pulled away. They started saying, well, we don't want to see you then because you're just so grim.
Right.
So here we get to the crimes. 2004, so 2 years after the stabbing, Saturday 10th of July, so probably a nice sunny day, Hobson and Claire, the girlfriend, went out for a drink at either a local pub downstairs or another one, if they're still barred, and then they went back to their flat. And Hobson
I don't know what the reason for, but he took a hammer and he hit her repeatedly over the head. So he struck her repeatedly. He left the hammer at the scene, so in the flat. He then washed her body whilst talking to her, and then put a bag over her head. And I think we've talked about this before. A lot of the time when a killer will put a bag over the head is because they know the victim.
They don't want to look at it.
They don't want to see. But he carried on talking to her as if she was alive, and he spent the next week living in the flat with her body.
So do you think it's like going into a state of shock almost, like he couldn't believe he'd done it?
At first I kind of thought maybe, you don't mistakenly hammer someone to death. It wasn't like he was doing a sex game and accidentally killed her. Yeah, so it wasn't accidental, it was definitely intentional. But I think there's an element of sort of disbelief there. But then 1 week after killing Claire, Hobson telephoned Diane, who was Claire's identical twin sister.
No!
Yeah, and said that Claire was ill and wanted to see her. Now, what I originally thought was that he was going to get Diane to come round and then pretend to be Claire.
Yeah, so like people would have seen her coming in at the house so they wouldn't know she was dead. They'd be like, yeah, we saw her yesterday.
Yeah.
That would work. Even if she appeared at the house, they'd be like, oh yeah, we've seen her around.
Which reminded me of a story.
On Friends.
In my real life where, and I'm not saying that a twin sister is like an armchair, but the story involves an armchair. I remember when I was about maybe 15, and do you remember my brother used to have house parties, which were kind of exciting? Like, yes. He used to have a lot of friends. Well, it was kind of that time, like the summer, my parents had gone away and he'd had quite a few house parties, but he also used to like to go out to town. He was a big socialite. Yeah, he still fucking is. But I woke up and I think it was really hot, so my window was open. And I woke up about maybe at 10 o'clock in the morning, normal. And I could smell like this, like, do you know when like plastic's burning? It smelled gross. Yeah. And I was like, holy shit, what the fuck is happening to my house? Am I going to die? And it turned out that my brother had gone out, got really drunk in town, invited two strangers back to our house while I'm sleeping upstairs. Weird. They'd come into the lounge. Like, it's my parents' house, not our house. They'd come into the lounge. One of them had been smoking, dropped a cigarette down the side of the cushion in the chair.
No!
And it just started smouldering, but left it there, not even said anything. So it just started smouldering and like melting the chair. So then my brother had said, oh, it's fine. And they just dragged the chair into the garden so I could smell it coming in from the garden. So I looked out my window. It's just
That's the drunk logic, isn't it? Yeah. It can burn just outside.
So it's just this armchair with smoke pouring out of it in the garden. And I went into my brother's room and said, you are fucked. My parents are going to go insane. Well, our parents are going to go insane. And he had a plan, which was a really clever plan. My parents had two of these chairs and they'd recently given an identical chair to my brother's friend. So all he was going to do was phone his friend, go get the identical chair, put it back in the lounge, get rid of the other one. They'd never know. It's amazing. I mean, it's jammy as fuck.
And is that what he did?
That's what he did. They never had a clue. Sorry, Mum, if you ever listen to this. So,
I want to tell her. Can I be there when you tell her?
Yeah. She would lose her shit. I mean, she probably wouldn't care now because...
She'd just go, oh, Nick.
Yeah.
You're still my favourite.
So, I'm not saying it's the same as that. But it's a little bit the same as
if you murder one twin, just swap it with the other.
Just get another one. But that's not what he did. Months before, he'd said to people that he felt like he'd chosen the wrong twin.
Oh, fuck off.
And that he wanted Diane. Although we do know some twins where there's like a good one and a rough one. It's a good, yeah. Emma's nodding. So there probably wasn't a rough one in this case.
Oh, okay.
But the ones that we know, yeah. So when Diane arrived at the flat, he did exactly the same to her. He struck her on the head with a hammer, but he also sexually assaulted her, and he bit her breasts really hard, so there were marks and problems with her breasts. And he also strangled her, and he put a bag over her head. But he'd obviously touched her sexually and had sort of wanted to do weird things to her. So these poor girls were killed brutally. He then, to add insult to injury, I think her boyfriend was waiting in the pub downstairs, so he went down and had a drink with him and said that the twins' father had died and they were both really upset, and then invited him up to the flat.
What was going to happen? What's the plan? Like, this is so unnecessary to kill the other twin, though. Do you think he, like, tried to convince her to be with him and she refused and that's when it went wrong?
Maybe.
What? I just want the whole set.
In for a penny, in for a pound. I don't know.
Oh, no. When you say spree killing, like, I imagine, like, on a rampage with strangers, but this is so...
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't want to say worse because they're both horrendous, but...
The reason I found it is I was trying to look for... if there'd ever been a twin who'd committed murder and then the wrong twin had been arrested and gone down right. for it, because I was watching...
Like The Prestige!
Well, I was watching Arrested Development, okay. Where the dad had a twin and then he shaved his head and... Have you seen it?
Yeah.
Yeah. But I couldn't... I found this through that. Now... Obviously, when the boyfriend goes into the flat, you've got one twin who's just been murdered, but you've got one twin who was murdered a week ago.
Yeah.
So the smell was really, really grim. And Hobson said it was the drains. I mean, it must have smelled worse than drains possibly could have. So Hobson got him out of the flat without seeing the bodies. He'd obviously hidden them somehow. And
so the man had gone into the flat where he thought his... girlfriend and sister were, didn't see them.
Yeah, he'd said, oh, they must have gone to stay with the mother.
Right.
So he'd said, oh, they're not here, they must have gone, like maybe shouted their names and said, oh, they've obviously gone home to the mother's because the father's died. So Ian, the boyfriend, the next day went to the twins' mother's and father's house to kind of say, I'm really sorry it was happened, check in on his girlfriend. Found the father, I mean, answered the door.
You would be...
Was alive.
So shocked.
I mean, that's awkward, isn't it? Oh, you're alive. Yes, I'm alive. And so they went to the flat together because the twins weren't there, obviously. Saying,
well, the game's up, isn't it? Like, it didn't... Yeah, he didn't go far enough into it to think, well, what will happen when he... realizes he's not dead.
Yeah. So Hobson wasn't there, but they found Claire and Diane's bodies.
Oh no.
And how mortifying for those parents to have lost two children.
And they have to see them in that way.
And there were also notes, and one was about Diane saying, Diane, use and abuse at will. So he'd obviously had these sexual intentions towards the twin. So word obviously spread really rapidly around the community that these crimes had been committed, that it was Hobson that had done them. So word started getting back to his children and his family. So they had people, like strangers in the street saying, have you heard about your dad?
Well, it'd be all around that pub, wouldn't it?
Yeah. And well, the police would have come and it would have been a big deal. But originally they told the family that it was a stabbing. So obviously the family were in complete shock. Then the police arrived and said, if you hear from Mark Hobson, you need to phone the police immediately. So, I mean, it is a scary thing to think, how do children deal with, say your parents get charged with murder or paedophilia? It's such a horrible thing to have to deal with, isn't it? It's just, I don't really know how you get over that. But obviously he'd been sort of descending into this state for a while, so he kind of detached from him a little bit. It's not like he was a loving father who'd done these things at that time. So he went on the run, and the murders made national news, so his photo was everywhere. And it soon became clear that there were more victims. So about 25 miles away, Hobson had gone into just a random house, probably to take money so that he could get further away. And without drawing anything out of a bank account, because that would have flagged him up immediately. So he went into James and Joan Britton's house. Now, they were in their 80s and they'd been married for 50 years. And James, yeah, I know. James Britton had Parkinson's, and Jane Britton could barely walk. So they were really kind of getting to that age where maybe they should be in a home or have some protection or help, but they were just sort of helping each other. A very sweet couple. And he'd entered through an unlocked back door, which, I mean, I don't even think twice about bothering to lock my doors. You just think,
well, when I came over now, I didn't know if you were back or not, and I saw the door was open, and I was pretty sure, like, that doesn't mean they're in. I was like, yeah, I could just go in and sit on the sofa by myself. Like, that doesn't mean anything at this house.
I mean, I was thinking, have I left a key out? They're probably somewhere. So even if we're not in, she could probably just let herself in. And so he'd gone straight upstairs, probably to rob them, and then found nothing. And then he'd attacked the couple quite savagely, and he'd beat them to death with a walking stick. So, I mean, not really any motive for this crime at all. So,
Or they possibly targeted them because they were easy to get in. Like, another couple, he might not have been able to just barge his way through to steal their money.
Yeah. But why kill them? Just go.
True.
Just go. So, obviously, there's two double murders in the area. Immediately, they think it must be Hobson, but they couldn't originally totally tie in with him because he doesn't know them. But then forensic evidence, so fingerprints, did link to Hobson.
Yeah, and he's not being careful and planning anything, is he? So, mistakes.
And people said that they'd see him in the area, and he did have quite a distinctive face, to be honest. So, and his photo was everywhere. So, after that, he spent 6 days. He didn't leave the area, but he just slept in a ditch under a hedge for 6 days. And 500 officers in the local area were looking for him. They were handing out flyers with his photo on. Obviously, they could track with CCTV, and they thought that he hadn't left the area because there was no evidence. Oh, he'd also got a lift to a local, so he'd got his mum to drive him to a hospital before the murders became apparent. So he'd kind of got that 25 miles away through a lift from his mum, and then he'd run from the hospital. And then the reason that he did get caught was because he went to a local garage to buy water and cigarettes, because after 6 days, that's what you want most.
You need a fag.
Yeah. And the garage worker instantly recognised him. Plus, he looked like shit. Like, he looked like he'd been living under
in a ditch.
In a ditch for 6 days. So he phoned the police immediately.
Like, you living in a ditch was one of the major slurs of the 90s as a kid.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, you live in a ditch, though.
Yeah.
That's what you say to everyone. Like, no matter what you were, you did not want to be living in a ditch.
Yeah.
Or being dead in a ditch.
Dead in a ditch.
I don't know how many ditches there are anymore.
I don't know of any ditches.
But if you die, space for you're going to be in a ditch. Like, my mum was convinced I would be dead in a ditch specifically. Whether she thought that I wasn't good at walking to slight inclines.
Walking home, falling in a ditch. But also, we're so built up, there's no room for ditches anymore. Every ditch is filled with cement, and they built a house on top of it. I mean, my house is inches from my neighbours. There's no fucking ditches around here. So then he obviously was going to go back to his little ditch, and then thought, oh, I think that guy might have recognised me, probably because he was looking at him weird. So he tried to walk back another way, and the police caught up with him and sort of chased him into a field. And he was dehydrated, he was taken to hospital, and then he was questioned. Straight away admitted to the murders. So that makes me think he's not a psychopath.
Like, there's no idea here. It does seem like some sort of, like we said before, some sort of injury or illness sort of thing, because it just, like, it's complete change, and then it's not planned, and he doesn't really seem to be, obviously he's on the run, so that's trying to escape the law.
But then
he's not good at it. I would say, was there an insanity plea?
He's like one of those rubbish people on Hunted where they literally just go down the road and stay in a tent.
It just seems like he doesn't know what he's doing. Like, it's just,
there was no, he just pled guilty from the beginning. So there's no sort of...
So they wouldn't do an insanity plea?
I don't think so. I think he said,
that's
I've
like
done
what happened in the Unabomber,
done.
Manhunt Unabomber on Netflix. You should watch it. It's super interesting.
Oh, my God.
But he was trapped. Like, he wanted to... Oh, my gosh. It was... I felt really sorry.
He's killed three people.
Yeah, but he had no choice. They made... They broke him down until he pled guilty. He didn't want to be insane. He wanted to get off on a technicality, and they trapped him.
Stop sympathizing with murder. This is not what this podcast is about. Is he still in prison? Maybe you should write to him.
He is still in prison, yeah. I know. It was just really well acted.
Yeah, maybe you just fancied the actor. So he was found guilty because he said he was guilty. And he was sentenced to lifelong imprisonment. And I think he wasn't expecting that, because when they said lifelong, they meant forever. So he did appeal against this on the basis that he was like, oh, well, I told you straight away.
Yeah, I was honest. Be kind.
And why have you given me so long? What about 200 hours community service?
But even if they did a life sentence for every person he'd killed, he'd still never get out.
Yeah. And he was only, he was only 34 when he'd done these crimes. He was very young. So during his stay in prison prior to the court case, which is something that quite a lot of people quite like him for, which is weird, but he'd attacked Ian Huntley, do you know, the caretaker who murdered the two schoolgirls. He'd poured a bucket of boiling water over him. So a lot of people were like, it's the only thing.
Oh, in prison?
Yeah, in prison.
Oh, I was going to say, if you're going to kill a lot of people, like...
Go for him. Yeah, in prison. He was obviously kept with him. So he was put in solitary confinement. And I think he was in solitary confinement for 3 months, which really would make you go insane, I think. But so I think he also sort of appealed against that. But obviously he was a danger to other people within the prison. He reportedly blamed alcohol for the murders and becoming an alcoholic. But he was also taking heroin, which probably didn't help.
Oh, we'll just sneak that in. Yeah.
But also, a lot of people take heroin. They don't go around murdering their girlfriends.
Oh, I guess.
And their twin sisters and nice elderly people. And there has been an investigation into lifelong imprisonment. So in 2007, they did kind of reconsider, can we do this? Is this a breach of human rights? But currently, there are no plans to change his sentence. So you never know. It might change. I mean, it would be scary if at some point they did sort of change it and let them all out at once. Because, I mean, it would make a good sci-fi film, but I don't think the reality would be very nice.
No.
So, I mean... That'd be
a weird episode of Big Brother.
Considering I don't think I've ever heard of him, that was quite a creepy one.
I feel like we should have done. Weird. Especially just being...
For UK...
Young like teenagers out on the streets when he was on the run.
No.
You'd think we'd have been aware of it.
In Yorkshire.
Our biggest danger was a ditch, not the men living in the ditch. Right. Okay, well, that was a good one. Thanks, DC. That's the end of our episode.
Hit subscribe. We never ask people to hit subscribe.
Hit subscribe.
We never tell them what the concept. This is a
subscribe violently.
It's a podcast where we talk about UK true crime.
We never tell them that. You can subscribe to it, and then you get to listen every week.
You get to you get to write a review if you want to.
We'll give you that.
A 5-star review. You can, if you want to, become a patron of the podcast. And
where you'll get access to the mother-daughter slaughter episode.
I mean, she hasn't done one for a while, but she has got one in mind for the next one, and I promise I'll try and get her to do it in the next week. And
we've also got some new designs coming up for stickers.
Yeah, so you get sent stickers, but we're in the process of getting some more exciting ones, because you might not just want our face, so there will be new stickers.
We've got a cute little Slash and Dasher coming.
A little Slash and Dash sticker. And if you sign up for enough, you get a tote bag. They are limited edition. It's only $10. I think that's pretty decent. I mean, you could sign up for a month and get one and cancel. Please don't. But you definitely could. Fuck it. It's $10 we've got.
I'm telling you, able to cancel.
And then what else can they do?
Join the Facebook group.
Join the Facebook
Chat
group.
Chat to us on Twitter. Email us.
slaughterthepodcast@gmail.com. And just keep listening and telling your friends about the
podcast. Follow us on Instagram if you like dogs and fireplaces.
And vegan food. Okay. So thanks for listening and have a great week. And we will see you again soon.
Bye.
Goodbye.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.